our Father and our God, being here on tonight in the first of these discussions, wilt thou bless us? For we know that we live in critical times. We know that the times are not what they ought to be. But, O Lord, wilt thou restore to this nation its Christian heritage, its Christian testimony, that we might speak boldly from the vantage point of Scripture to all the issues of the day. And so with this in view, we pray unto thee that thou will enlighten our minds, open our hearts, use our tongues, use our minds for the glory of thine own Son, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. I should tell you something more about myself. I was originally trained in American constitutional history. I have been involved in several presidential campaigns and local campaigns, the North Carolina campaign, in direct politics. I have been advisor to a Senate committee, the Smith-McCarran Committee, which was a subcommittee of the Federal Senate's Committee on the Judiciary. I served as advisor to Senator Will Smith and Senator Pat McCarran for 2 years. I have personally worked with Jesse Helms and do help him and advise him on certain occasions. I wrote for him. I wrote material for him for his book. With my permission to use that, I don't mean anything. So that I've had connections with politics all my life. I first came up with Strom Thurmond in 1948, and he's a close friend of our family. I know him well. I know Jesse Helms well. I knew Senator Smith well until he died. There's no connection between my knowing him and his death, however. He worked too hard and died of a heart attack. And I don't know how many different political campaigns I've worked in. So I've seen the practical side of American political life. I also worked for the Pearl Harbor Investigating Commission, a committee of Congress. Actually, I did the work in the military rather than Congress itself, but I did the same type of work. During the war, I was area director for the War Manpower Commission. The head of that was an Indiana drunk by the name of Paul McNutt. And between him and I was one of, about 30 or 40 area directors. And between him and us, there was sort of a field officer who stood between the area director and Paul McNutt. It was part of the federal bureaucracy. In 1943, I forget the date, but the Saturday Evening Post came out with one of its cartoons making fun of the War Manpower Commission. And here's the setting. There's a farmer sitting out in his front lawn, and he has one of these sewing machines that you use with your feet, you know, and he had about three different wires attached to each ear. He had five wires to each finger, 10 wires to his hands, and he had 10 wires to his toes. And he had a horizontal, and he had wires coming out here. And in other words, he was a collection of wires. And he was trying to operate the whole farm with these wires attached to his head. And the War Manpower Commission member came out and said, "Are you in need of help?" Of course, no, he was doing the whole thing by himself, which is a ridiculous question. Now, obviously, he did. And he did need help. And I did everything from hiring a former FBI man to spy on an army installation to see what they were doing wrong and flooding. That was a very brave and stupid thing to do, but I got away with it. And working with a general who got shot, not in war, but by an irate farmer whose daughter he had violated, and the farmer got out a shotgun and thought he was hunting squirrels or bear, and his aim was right good. The man wasn't killed, but farmer did have to move him. He would have been. And I had all sorts of experiences like that. Working with the hierarchy and the bureaucracy in Washington was a great education. Working for the War Manpower Commission was a graduate course in itself. I stood for 3 years, and when I wanted to get out, I got out, they let me go. Well, they didn't let me go, but they transferred me. When I told my superior I wanted to get out of it, he said, "Well, if you do, they'll draft you in the Army." I looked him in the eye and I said to him, "Can I agree that, can you guarantee that?" And he says, no, I don't think I can, which is typical. But they realized that I was utterly fed up with it. I was utterly disgusted. The corruption was unbelievable, and the incompetence insurmountable. Government bureaucracies are inherently corruptible and inherently incompetent. I don't mean everybody in them is, Emily. Well, those who don't become incorrupt end up with the male case. She's not there either. But I should say, I worked with one general who was a good man. He was above corruption, and I really got along well with him. All I'm trying to do is simply tell you that I've had experience in the practical affairs of government and in the political aspect of government. And I survived it. I got out before I got corrupted, and I got out before I became mentally ill. But if I stayed with the Pearl Harbor Commission, I would have gone then. One of my friends, then I won't mention, they taught English at the College of Charleston, and a member of a very, very ancient, old, and honorable Prussian family, had been drafted into the army. And after they got him in, they gave him a psychic test, and they discovered they'd made a mistake. But army life, they would never admit it. But they did decide he couldn't go into active warfare. So they put him down where I worked. We worked in submarine vaults under land, wasn't underwater, but it was a vault under down deep. And at the entrance, they had armed guards. And they did to you what they do to you when you go in the airplane. They pictured everything you had on and everything was on you. And you worked with armed guards at your back. Because if you in any way did anything to, or let anything out of the bag, you had a $10,000 fine, and you had 10 years in the Federal Hotel in Atlanta. It was not the Henry Grady, which was the big hotel in those days. It wasn't. It was better than the federal penitentiary. So you kept it everything to yourself. By that time, I was made of sterner stuff. But my friend, whose name I shall not mention, went completely haywire. And they had the usual naval inquiry, and they put him in a... They'd taken up some old houses there with these great big French windows, and turned them into part of the naval hospital there. And he took a flying jump one day and went straight through the window. It fortunately was on the first floor. And of course, you don't jump through plate glass windows without making considerable noise. And they found him lying, bloodied and all outside. I don't know how many stitches they took. They spent hours stitching him up. And he survived. And then they had another naval inquiry, the second one. And it was a very interesting inquiry. They decided they'd made a mistake, which was obvious to everybody but them. And they retired him honorably on a medical discharge. Actually, he tried to kill himself. They finally caught on that he was not up to par. But the point was, the fellow was a fine Christian fellow. He was excellent. He was an excellent scholar. He was doing good work. But what we found at in this particular subterranean deal would blow your mind. Considerably about Pearl Harbor, that it was known that the president knew it, that he had planned for it, and the date the documents were dated, beginning in July 1939. I think the date was 29th or 25th, I forget which, but I don't know if this stuff's been declassified or not. Under the Nixon administration, they started to declassify the Pearl Harbor documents, but there were, I don't know how many there were of them, but I know that when the commission made its report to Congress, they had 10 million words and 10,000 pages of documentary material. And you have some idea, and that didn't begin to scrape the material, because I looked and the stuff that was in there, the material I worked with was not there. Where it wasn't, where it is now, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Even I suspect maybe on the politicos may have destroyed it if they could have, because it was so damaging. I was made of sterner stuff, and by that time I guess I was used to the hierarchy. So the result was that I survived nervously, and my friend didn't. He is now all right, I might add. He recovered and went back to teaching where he should have been left. That's just an introduction from my background, this course. I originally started majoring in constitutional history. I did my dissertation in constitutional history. I studied under two of the three most famous constitutional historians this country's ever had. St. George Leacon Sousa, the third was one of them, and he was a very, very great man. And Dr. H.V. Ames, the fourth, was the other one. They all had a lineage which they, of which they're very proud. Dr. Ames was president of the Mayflower Society of America and was quite happy, not proud, I don't blame him. And he looked like John Winthrop, as if he just walked off the boat. So that my early training was in constitutional history. At the same time, I majored in church history under a very noted authority who was an atheist. But he wanted Calvinists on his faculty. And so we got along very well. He respected us. Now that's my pedigree, such as it is. And I hope I have not discouraged you. Because now I want to begin a discussion with you looking up to the election. Now, you cannot understand the current discussions, such as they are, concerning elections, unless you know the history, let me put it another way, unless you know the nature of the American heritage. I listened to Mr. Como last night, or was it, it was one night this week. It was last night. The governor of New York, who gave the what he thought was the exposition of the Roman Catholic view. He said that his bishop didn't agree with him, which would be obvious. But he said he respected his bishops. I was impressed with the amount of respect he paid them. After saying he respected the bishops, he then went off on a tangent and very politely said that privately he agreed with them, but as a politician he couldn't. Which leads you in a quandary. My position would be, if he agreed with them privately, he should agree with them publicly. Because I agree with the bishop's position, not his. When Mr. Mondale set forth to say that God is a Republican, according to Mr. Reagan, that leaves considerable doubt in my mind as to the knowledge which Mr. Mondale has of American history. Considerable doubt. And when you read, or when you hear the men, Ted Koppel and others of similar ilk, discuss it on TV, or read the Atlanta Constitution, which I sometimes do read when I'm waiting for a plane, and I've reduced to sheer desperation. More frequently, I read the Shalom Observer every morning, because the only newspaper we have is Salisbury. Salisbury, I should say, is a huge town of 22,501 people. And thus, I know the sheer magnitude of the size will overwhelm you who live in a little puny place like Atlanta. But we have to depend upon the Shalom Observer or Good Morning America. And, well, I'm not entranced by the Shalom Observer. I'm less entranced by Good Morning America. I do read the Shalom Observer. And I'm daily confused by that same paper. I'm confused by much of the religious literature which I see, by the official pronouncements of General Assemblies, Methodist conferences, Baptist associations, and whatnot. I'm not throwing off the Baptist. I mean, Christians are just as bad.
I am too.
Well,
I'm confused.
Well, I don't blame you. Now, the textbook for the course is this. Now, I admit this is my own book, and I don't like to parade my own book. I'll force you to read it, but there's no other book like it, which may or may not be good. In its defense, I would say that this is the second edition. The first edition went through 9 printings, and it came out in 1964, and by 1980, it needed updating. And so the publishing company informed me that they were out of the 9th printing. They were gone. They had nothing left. And I had known that because people write to me and say, can we get copies of the book? And there was none to be obtained. It was all sold out. So I put 70 additional pages in. I aimed a better index and a large bibliography. and it came out in the second edition. The second printing of that is now gone, or almost gone. I'm not sure which. They're supposed to let me know this month. So that has gone through 12 printings, which is not too bad for a book. And so, with due modesty, I do suggest that you buy it, or at least get a copy of it through Hook or Crook if you don't want to buy it. Now, you might want to look at a little book called The Church and the Sword out there. I did that with Commander Russell Evans, who was a retired Coast Guard commander, who had had active service during the war, both in the Coast Guard and U.S. Navy. He was the commander of a destroyer, and the result is he had a great deal of naval and military information which he could get, and I used, and he used the historical material well, and we did it together. He used my material and somebody's own, and it's a shorter book called The Church and the Sword. It's a study of the military of the effect of the National Council of Churches and the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran churches, the United Church of Christ, and the Northern Baptist Convention on military unpreparedness. It's been highly praised by Senator Jeremiah Denton and other people of some understanding. It's a shorter book, much shorter, but it covers the essential points of the infiltration of liberalism into the situation. Now, this will be the textbook, and right now I'm going to introduce you to the basic meaning of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, for our purposes, has two clauses: that Congress shall not establish any religion, nor in any way interfere or abridge the liberty and the right to have one's religion. Now, that statement has a great deal of meaning. And the meaning of it is to be found in the debates in the first Congress, which met in 1789 and 90, in the Annals of Congress. The Annals of Congress is a publication which is the forerunner of the present congressional record. The record, the minutes of the speeches in Congress went through three developments. Until 1835, it was known as the Annals of Congress. At that time, it became known as the Congressional Globe, because Andrew Jackson awarded the contract for publishing it to the editor of the Washington Globe. So it simply became another Globe with the Globes. During the war between the states, it became known as the Congressional Record. And that is the title on which it goes today. But there's also another source to know exactly what the men who wrote the Ten Amendments had in mind, and that is a book called Eliot's Debates on the Federal Constitution, which is in four volumes. It contains the debate in the Philadelphia Convention. It contains the debate in the 13 ratifying conventions. It contains the debate in the first Congress much more fully in regard to the meaning and the intent and the nature of the First Amendment. I do not understand why Mr. Mondale is in such confusion as to the meaning of the First Amendment. I do not understand why the editors of the Atlantic Constitution don't conserve Eliot. I can't believe they don't know it exists. And it is certainly available in Emory University Library and other libraries of like size. What I'm saying then is that the meaning of the First Amendment is readily available. There's no question about it. It's also discussed in the writings of James Madison, of course, who was the man who had most to do with the actual phraseology of the First Ten Amendments, a member of the First Congress in Virginia, as well as the Philadelphia Convention. He left no doubt to what he had in mind, and the other members of the First Congress left no doubt what they had in mind. These things are not mysteries. It's simply a matter of being willing to read and to understand what is very clear, and what down the recent times was very clear to members of Congress. And when the Supreme Court was a Supreme Court, and not a group of misunderstood, misled, and befuddled sociologists, the court can understand. There's no mystery. The First Amendment clearly forbade Congress to have an established state church. And the reason for that was this, that just before the War for Independence, the Bishop of London in the Anglican Church, who had neglected the colonies from 1628 until 1774, suddenly decided they should have a colonial episcopate, which is to say they would have bishops for the colonies in the Anglican Church named by the Anglican Church in England. And the colonists decided they didn't want that. Now that has been one of the reasons for the War for Independence, which has never been widely circulated. But Bernard Bailyn, a great American historian, wrote a book on it called The Mitre and the Sceptre, in which he pointed this out, that a great deal of discontent was raised, not only in New England, where the Puritans were strong, but in Virginia. The Virginians didn't want an established church. The South Carolinians didn't. The North Carolinians didn't. The Middle States didn't. So when they got around to writing the Constitution, North Carolina, Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York demanded a Bill of Rights. Now you see, that's four states. And for the Constitution to be effective, there had to be the vote of at least nine states. That made the decision very much in doubt. So they agreed to have a Bill of Rights. And they agreed that the first of the Bill of Rights would deal with freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Now note, the first or the whole of the Bill of Rights are a restriction on the powers of Congress. And by meaning that, the framers of the Bill of Rights meant the entire federal government. It's not just Congress, it's the Supreme Court. It's the president. Neither the president by himself, Congress by itself, nor the Supreme Court by itself can erect a state church. Neither can they involve themselves in religious affairs. They cannot prevent the free exercise thereof, meaning religion. This is why the Supreme Court in the Bob Jones case was way, way, way off base. There is no constitutional, there's no legal, and there's actually no traditional support for that case. Now, I haven't asked the question, believe me, I'm not going to ask this question until the last part of this course. I don't mean to say I won't be on the road, but the final answer will come later. And tonight, I'm simply giving you a preview, and I'm laying the groundwork for what I'm going to say. Now, incidentally, I meant to tell you, I do not mind questions. The four victims whom I spot here are quite well aware that I do not mind questions. I don't hold them against you. I don't regard them as foolish. And I will do the best with my limited knowledge to try and answer them. And if I don't answer, because I don't know the answer. Yes, sir.
You meant the tax exemption.
I meant the tax exemption. I just assumed you knew the Bob Jones case. Bob Jones University. I'm not saying now what I agree with, I don't agree with what Bob Jones was doing. But they had the right to do it. Yes, sir, Dennis.
You may be planning on covering this. In talking about the First Amendment here, we're talking about the Congress not being able to start an established church. Was there the right of any state to do that?
Good question. You will note that the First Amendment is a set of 10 restrictions on Congress. They are not on the states. If they had been, the Constitution would never have been passed. After all, there is such a thing as state sovereignty. And the sovereign states created the Federal Union. The Union is the subject of the states. You might know, in my political theory, I'm a devout follower of John C. Calhoun and Alexander H. Stevens. I'm an unreconstructed 1860 Democrat. That's why I vote Republican. But I am convinced, after many, many years of study, that their position is the correct position. Now, there is no prohibition on the state as to the establishment of religion? And the answer is very simple. When the Constitution was written, at least 9 of the states had some form of state support for the churches. In Connecticut and Massachusetts, they paid the salaries of the clergymen. In Virginia, the Anglican Church was the favored church. In South Carolina, the Anglican Presbyterian churches were favored because the Huguenots and the Scotch-Irish were devout Presbyterians, and they were about equal to Anglicans in power in the state. In New York, the Dutch Reformed Church. In New Jersey, the Dutch Reformed Church. In Pennsylvania, the Scotch-Irish and the Quakers. In Maryland, strangely enough, it was between the Puritans and the Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholic Church was very powerful in Maryland, under the Carroll family, a very honored and esteemed and revered family, and there was a large pocket of Britons in Maryland. And so it goes. The only state where there's no real tie was Rhode Island, which was controlled by the Baptists. And being controlled by the Baptists, while there was no support of the church, it was nicely arranged that only Baptists held office. But that's just an informal agreement. So that, let me make this final point, now I'm going to go back. It was the consensus of all the members of the Philadelphia Convention, the state ratifying convention, and the members of the first Congress that Christianity would be the religion of the new nation. They never dreamed for a moment that it would not be. Now, if Congress was not allowed to have a union of church and state, there was no prohibition on having a union of theology and political theory and practice. Do you follow me? In other words, there's absolutely no reason why President Reagan cannot voice his expression at a presidential prayer breakfast. There's absolutely no reason why Christmas cannot be celebrated in the public schools of the nation. Absolutely none. There's absolutely no reason for not having a manger scene in City Hall Square in Podunk Center. And Podunk Center happens to want it. Or Paducah, Kentucky, or Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or New York City. There's absolutely no reason for not to have Christmas carols sung in the public schools. None at all. There's no legal reason, there's no constitutional reason, there's no traditional reason, there's no reason, period. I'm not trying to offend anybody here tonight. I am trying to make you think. I am trying to show you the truth. I don't speak things like I have done. I might also say that I am a radio commentator for an ABC outlet for Central North Carolina. WSAT, your family radio, 1280 in Salisbury, North Carolina. I've done it for 22 years, and they haven't thrown me off yet. I'm on the air morning and evening, Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, 8:35 in the morning, 6:20 in the evening. I'm on tape tomorrow, I'm a wife, and then I have a call-in program on Tuesdays from 1:05 to 1:35, when they call in questions such as like you ain't never seen or heard. Everything I'm saying, express their opinion. It's sort of a free-for-all. I have to be on my, really on the alert. So I'm very careful what I say.
I had wondered about your support of John Calhoun in view of his support of the central bank.
Well, you must remember that the central bank in his day was not the central bank of the day. Many people overlook that fact. You see, in his day, the country had somewhere around 3,500 wildcat banks. Nobody knows the exact number. And they each print their paper money. And this is literally true. If you go back and read the record, you go to a town like I had mentioned, Paducah, Kentucky. It's a good place to begin with. And you'd have the first state bank of Paducah, Kentucky. It would be chartered. And it might have $2,000 worth of cash involved, on basis of which you could print $50,000, $100,000 worth of paper money. Now, when you get $100,000 of paper money with $2,000 cash reserve, you're in for trouble. And this was true all over the country. and it was sheer chaos. And the result was that, as you may remember, when they in 1816 they chartered the first bank in the United States. Now, who was president when this was done? Well, it's not a fair question. It was the last few months of James Madison's administration. Monroe was elected in 1816, but he came in 1817. Now, Madison was a strict constructionist, wasn't he? Yeah, he was. Calhoun was a strict constructionist. Yes, he was. Although he was not as strict at that time as Madison. These men realized that a central bank of some kind was necessary, but its powers were restricted. It was not the Federal Reserve type of federal central bank, but it was needed to put out a currency which could be accepted. For instance, if you, let's say you were a merchant, or you were traveling, let's say, from New York to Ohio in 1816, and you had some beautiful notes, just beautiful notes, from the First State Bank of New York City, just the prettiest things you can imagine, and you go out to Bowling Green, Ohio, and you want to get in a hotel, and you give the man at the desk this beautiful paper of money, he'd say, "But where'd you get that stuff? I wouldn't use it. I wouldn't accept it." And it was very difficult. When the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad got rolling, it printed its own money that the conductors could accept, because when you went in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, you would go in, and maybe you brought some money, let's say, from some little town, Pennsylvania, and you want to get the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. You know what you do? You go up to the cash desk, and the man said, "Look, you got $100 here. That's nice, but you see, we'll give you $25 for it. And if you want to ride our train, you better take it." You see my point? It was utter chaos. Because at that time, the states had used the right to print their own currency, and thus to allow the state bank, for that's the only kind there was, to print its currency. And there was tremendous fluctuation in value. And also, when you have about 3,000 different types of banknotes in circulation, another great business flourished, counterfeiting. Because there was no American banknote company to print the bank paper. You see my point? I'm not anti-government. I just believe in bringing the federal government back when it's historical limits. Now, yes,
sir. This is a case that just popped in my head. Maybe if I thought about it a while, maybe I'd change my mind about bringing it up. But
go ahead.
I think it's interesting. You probably have this at your fingertips. When the Mormon Church had the trouble with the government, do you recall how the government forced them not to allow
Yes, that was on admission to Utah. Yes.
What happened there?
Well, see, Utah was created a territory under the Northwest Ordinance Act of 1787. Now, when Utah had the appropriate 60,000 settlers, which was the requisite number for becoming a state, they were told to call a state constitutional convention, which drew up a constitution. As a result, they drew up a constitution which did not outlaw the plurality of wives. And so they rejected, the federal government, the Congress rejected the first state constitution, and Utah did not get in. But they said, if you want to get in, you'll have to redraw your constitution to insist upon monogamy rather than polygamy. And so, with tongue in cheek, they redrew the constitution. But you see, the problem was that some of the Mormon bishops already accumulated 10 or 12 wives, and the problem arose when you can't just throw up the 11 or 12 wives out in the gutter. And secondly, I can imagine what would go on between the 12 wives when you did. I mean, it'd be a real civil war. And so once the state was admitted, then they reinstated polygamy. Because you see, at that time, the state's rights concept held, and a federal government could not intervene in what was regarded as a religious situation, namely polygamy. But you see, as long as the territory could and did. Does that answer your question?
I just wonder if they had the Mormons. I'm glad they did it the way they did it. I just wonder if they raised a big fuss on the census.
Well,
the federal, what position would we take if that was a hot issue now?
Well,
would we say there's anything at this point that the federal government sees or shouldn't come in?
The technical point is this, that a territory, unlike a state, is a creation of Congress. In other words, a territory becomes a territory when it has 5,000 people within a given geographical area. That's under the Act of 1787. Now, between that time, when it's a recognized territory with an appointed territorial governor, and the time when it has 50,000 inhabitants and is allowed to create its own government under the Act of 1787, during that period of time, whatever time it takes, that territory is under control of Congress, and Congress may legislate for a territory in a way it cannot legislate for a state. In other words, Congress has much more power over territory than it does over a state. And the Constitution was speaking. Congress was within its rights. Since it was a territory. Congress did exercise its powers over Puerto Rico, for instance, that it could not exercise over a state. It still does. One of my friends was governor of the Samoan Islands for a while, and that's quite an experience. Have you been there?
Yes. I can see what it would be as an experience.
Well, he told me he had to do things weren't in the book.
Yeah, a great deal of welfare.
Yeah. I saw you laughing. I figured you must have been somewhere else.
Gone. I think like one side of the island. You beast off the other side.
But when were you there?
Oh, 4 months ago.
Oh, were you? This man's not there now. He was Earl Root from Salisbury. He was governor of the Samoan Islands.
He was doing some work down in down on Haiti side.
Yeah, I know what it is.
It's similar to the same situation.
The issue today, in its simplest terms, is this. Is there such a thing as the American religious heritage, or is there not? Or, to rephrase, was America basically a religious nation, a Christian nation, or was it not? There are three answers to that question. Practically all political, social, and economic liberals deny there was ever a Christian nation. I suppose, in his own interesting way, the one exception was Jimmy Carter, who sort of tugged on both positions at the same time. But of course, Carter was never consistent, and so we probably shouldn't hold him up as an example. But he was something of an exception to what I said. Almost all liberals are of the opinion or the conviction that we never were a Christian nation. There's a group, a small group, but pretty vocal, who call themselves a neo-evangelical. This group holds, yes, there was a Christian heritage for a short time, but it disappeared in the colonial period. Therefore, we are no longer a Christian nation. They have come out, so far as the president is concerned, to agree with liberals. The most notable example of this is Mark Hatfield. Although he's not entirely consistent, but George Marston, Richard Perard, hey, strike this off the record, Mark Knoll, and others of this group attack the idea that we have a Christian heritage, and sometimes go separately. There's a third group, and this is composed of historic, traditional Roman Catholics and Protestants of various ecclesiastical membership, who hold that we do have a Christian heritage, and that it is to be preserved, and that this election is a critical moment when it will be decided whether we shall or shall not preserve it. In other words, this election is in the eyes of many people, will be determining whether that Christian heritage shall be a viable heritage or whether it shall be hung up in a historic museum to be gazed upon and then forgotten. That this is the issue as I see it, with these three possibilities.
Well, what's the second one?
I call it the position of the neo-evangelicals.
You mentioned George Marston?
Yes.
Is that the name from Town and Town?
Yes. He wrote a chapter for a book to which I contributed in which he did this very thing. Are you familiar with him?
Sorry.
Yeah, well, Papa George was not that way. Now, the question is, before the house, do we have such a Christian heritage, such a Christian legacy, and of what is it composed? I shall try to use the rest of our time to answer this question. Let me begin by giving a resounding yes to answer that question. There is a Christian heritage. It is written indelibly in our law books. It is written indelibly in our traditions. It is written indelibly in our constitutional heritage, in our legal heritage. And no man who becomes president can dismiss it with a wave of the hand and say it ain't so. Now, why do I say this? Well, let me give you a brief history. Incidentally, this is sort of funny. In 1981, I was called by the Attorney General of the state of Kentucky to give a deposition before that high tribunal, well, before the Attorney General, to give support to the Kentucky law providing for the having the Ten Commandments clearly and permanently posted in each classroom. Three of us were asked to give depositions. R.J. Rushden of California and a very, very fine Roman Catholic priest from the University of Louisville, who was the head of the education department there. He was sharp. And I gave the third one. By the time I got there, the attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union was punched drunk. If anybody knows R.J. Rushden, he was in high gear. The attorney had had a hard time. And he had not yet recovered when they brought this Roman Catholic priest in, who was the professor of education. And he told me afterwards what he said. And I could tell that he had a tremendous effect upon the attorney, because the attorney knew what had come or gone. And what he asked the attorney was this, very interesting, the ACLU attorney said, suppose you're a little girl, you have a little girl that was in the public school, and another student stole her purse, what would you do? And he said, I get awfully angry. And he said, I go to the authorities. And the professor said, well, why would you? If religion is no place in the public schools, and obviously, there's no such thing as theft. Suppose you have a daughter 15, and a senior tried to rape her who might be a sophomore or junior in high school. He said he'd get very angry. I said, well, why would you? I said, if there's no religion to be taught, no religious heritage, he said, why do you get upset? And the lawyer had absolutely no answer. I went in there, and they asked me to give the historical resume to prove you had this heritage. And I started off, as I shall start off, with the Magna Carta and the Constitution of Clarendon and early English documents. And I started off, and I realized the lawyer kept looking at me, and he just kept looking at me. And I realized he didn't understand a word I was saying. He's a graduate, I think, of Yale Law School. And I said, do you understand what I'm talking about? He said, no, frankly, I don't. But the Attorney General overruled and said, keep on going. And I could see the Attorney General sort of holding himself in. And and finally, we got up to 18th century English law. I said, oh, yes, I'm beginning to see. By that time, I'm only going through 7th century. and finally I got up to, I went through English common law and all the developments there. And finally, after I'd done this for about 35-40 minutes, the attorney just said, "No, it's all we need, Mr. Singer. I'm calling this deposition to halt." And he said, "Now to the lawyer," he said, "would you care to cross-examine the witness?" And I expected to have a long, grueling time. He got up and ran out of the room, literally ran out of the room. I looked at the attorney general. I said, "What have I done wrong? Because I thought I was in for trouble." And he was laughing. And I said, "Well, what did I do?" He said, "You didn't do anything except thoroughly confuse him." I said, "When a lawyer knows he's lost his case, he gets up and runs down the room. He retreats as fast as he can." And of course, the Kentucky Supreme Court did uphold it. But the United States Supreme Court, without reading the deposition, refused to hear the case and left it and set it aside on the circuit court. In that decision, we had the loyal support of Roman Catholics. I don't know about the whole hierarchy, but certainly the University of Louisville was right behind us in this thing. That's the answer to that problem. Now, what is our heritage? Do we have a heritage? Yes. First of all, we have a legal heritage. I'm not familiar with the civil code and the criminal code of North Carolina, of Georgia, but I do know that in Chapter 17 of the Common Law Codification in the state of North Carolina, you have a complete reiteration of the Ten Commandments. This is also true in Virginia, it's true in South Carolina, it's true in Maryland, it's true in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, New York, and the New England states. Which is to say, the common law is the fabric of our legal system. Now, what does this mean? During the Middle Ages, there were two systems of law, particularly in England, with which we're concerned. There was the canon law, which was being developed in Rome for the most part, although the papacy used the lawyers trained by the University of Bologna, which was the most famous law school in the Middle Ages, and it turned out excellent lawyers. Alongside that, but different from it, in England, was the development of English common law. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting that canon law and common law were totally opposed. I'm saying they were different. The canon law was largely designed to provide, shall we say, the legal and the administrative structure for the church. What the bishops can and cannot do, what the clergy can and cannot do, so on and so on, which is perfectly legitimate. The common law, as it developed in Great Britain, is very important. When William the Conqueror conquered England in 1066, he subjugated the whole feudal structure in England to himself. But by 1100, they began to develop in England as what we call common law. Now, its origins are biblical. The canon law was biblical, but its structural aspect, note what I'm saying, as it provides for church structure, it was derived largely from Roman law. Roman law provides the structure for the Roman church. The scriptures provide the moral and ethical content of canon law. See that distinction? I should have said that before. Is that what you wanted to get at?
Yeah, I wanted to tell
you. Yeah. Now, in England, that was not the case in the same sense. The common law was feudal law, and feudal law was based upon the scriptures. The feudal law was the first form of the governmental legal system in Great Britain, in England. But Henry the First, 1100 to 1137, and Henry the Second, 1154 to 1181, provided the court system framing them. To a degree. There had already been local courts, but they were run by the feudal barons. If you were a Duke of Somerset, in Somerset you had your own court, and you decide the law according to your own life. If you were the Duke of Wales, you did the same thing. A Duke of North Anglia did the same thing. East Mercia did the same thing. But in the reign of Henry I, he instituted a system of appellate courts, or they were called the courts of pied pudre, the courts of dusty feet, by which we mean that he set up itinerant justices who held circuit courts all over England and each of the main parts of England, to which injured parties could appeal. If your duke or your baron gave a decision against you as one of his peasants or his landholders, you had the right to appeal with the next session of the court. Now these justices administered the court of the King's Bench, the central court, all over England. And their decisions gave England a common law, common sense, that the decisions were made all over England according to the law as it was interpreted in London. Now that law was biblical in content, so that the English common law became, not in every type, jot and tittle, not in every provision, but the Ten Commandments and the Scriptures furnished the background for the whole of the common law and its application. Derived from Scripture, with its structure being somewhat determined by the feudal government of England, with the barons, the counts, the dukes, and then ultimately the king. But the king had a central court, known as the Court of King's Bench, which was a kind of supreme court for that day. And you could make your final appeal to that court. Now, in the famous Magna Carta of 1066, this was started. But in later decisions, the Constitution of Clarendon, and ultimately in a very famous act known as the Magna Carta, this common law of England was made much more secure. The background, of course, was the controversy between the Pope Innocent III and John of England, and the attempt of John to recover the provinces in France. And he'd levied taxes on the barons, and the barons revolted. Now, so that John was brought to bay by the barons at Runnymede and forced to sign the Great Charter, the Magna Carta, which reiterated the limitations of power in previous documents, the judicial system, and bound the barons to observe the central judicial system, and in essence was a reaffirmation of the biblical content of English common law for the whole kingdom. This result was also aided by a very famous English jurist, John of Salisbury, who lived in the little town of Salisbury, from which my hometown gets its name. And he wrote a book on the law of England, which is a magnificent statement of case, in which John of Salisbury, an ardent believer, although he was not a high in the church, ecclesiastically, but a very ardent believer and a great student of law, set forth a whole basis of English common law. Again, emphasizing its Christian content and importance. Without going into all the detail, because I want to get into the American side, this development kept taking place in England, and of course, in 1689, at the time of the Bloodless Revolution, the Parliament issued the famous Bill of Rights. John, had you nothing to say?
I was going to say you might comment on the theme about the time, we came to Babylon over.
Oh, yes, well, that's true. You may remember when Elizabeth died, she died without a child, which threw the question of the English throne wide open. Now, James was 6th of Scotland with her cousin. His mother was Mary Queen of Scotland. She was Roman Catholic. He was Protestant. And under the Act of Supremacy of 1534, the successor to the throne had to be a Protestant. Therefore, James became James I of England. The word stubborn does not adequately describe his character. Stubborn men can be moved. James couldn't be. Even when he was right, which is blessedly true, sometimes he was right. But right or wrong, nothing doing. He got in trouble with Parliament. And as you know, he died in 1625, and his son, Charles I, came in. And by that time, the Puritans had risen to power in England. They were in the control of the situation. And Charles continued his father's unwise policies, but he was more stubborn and lacked his father's sense and lacked his father's character. And of course, in 1629, the Long Parliament began, the result of which was the famous Cromwellian Revolution, which opened in 1643. This had a tremendous effect upon English law, because the Puritans, who had become a force in the 1570s at the Cambridge University under Thomas Cartwright, were almost all, they all dealt with the law in one way or another. And one of the great exponents, of course, was Samuel Rutherford, who wrote Lex Rex, to show forth the relationship between the kingdom, that is the political state on one hand, and the law of God on the other. You ought to read that book. It's been republished just recently. I forget by what publishers, but it's there to get. If you really want to know political thinking, Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex is a tremendous book on the biblical position in regard to church and state. Lex, L-E-X. L is an R-E-X, Rex. In English, it's law and king.
Well, wasn't another one too Thomas More?
Pardon me?
Thomas More.
What about him?
When he refused to consent to marriage.
Oh, yes. Henry put him to death.
That was one of the real
political. Who? Yeah, see, Thomas More was one of the most gifted writers of the Renaissance. He wrote some very excellent material in praise of folly and for some other books, but was he was an able statesman. In fact, he was chancellor of the realm under Henry VIII, which means he was the attorney general, so to speak. When Henry wanted to divorce Catherine, Thomas More took an extremely dim view of that situation. As a matter of fact, it was so dim that he issued an injunction against him. And that displeased Henry, because he long grown tired of Catherine. And in the meantime, he got Anne pregnant. And Thomas More refused to take note of such bad problems and refused to grant the divorce. And of course, Thomas was backed up by Charles V of Germany. Catherine, you see, was the aunt of Charles V of Germany. And Charles, who was a pretty good man anyway, he was very upset, extremely upset, extremely upset. When Henry wanted to divorce his aunt, as a matter of fact, he was so upset that he told the Pope, Clement VII, that if he did divorce Catherine of Aragon, it would be the last act he did on earth. And to reinforce that position, he marched down and put the Pope in prison to show that Charles was not given the judgment. Of course, he put Francis I in the same prison. He was the height of his power. And under those conditions, Clement VII got extremely moral, even though he was a de Medici, and decided he just could not grant the divorce. It just wasn't right, because he had the sword at his throat. And as a result, Cranmer, a very brilliant, at that time, a time-serving politician in the church, going through the law books, found out that Julius II had uncanonically married Henry and Catherine. Because Catherine had been betrothed to Henry's older brother, Arthur, who had died. And so What Cranmer did was not to divorce them, as the textbooks say, but he granted an annulment, which saved the embarrassment of divorce. And it earned Cranmer's promotion to Archbishop Canterbury, and it earned Catherine's early retirement, Social Security, and Anne's elevation to the Queen of. But Sir Thomas More was put to death for his position in regard to this whole matter. One of the most brilliant men of his day. Some might say the most brilliant. I'm not going to argue that one way or the other. But he certainly was a towering giant intellectually. It was sad, but it happened. Now, the rise of the Puritan movement was a tremendous impact upon the biblical content of English thought. If I might use a term out of context, and certainly out of historical context, I would say the Puritans were very close to being the theonomists of their day. They believed in the complete incorporation of biblical law into the actual civil and criminal codes of England. Having given that English background, let us look at the American picture, shall we? Am I doing what you want me to do? See, I just can't go into today's picture. I'm a trained historian. I have to give the historical background. I feel as if I'm committing intellectual adultery if I don't. Or intellectual murder, some other crime.